It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is back tomorrow. Coming up, we'll get the latest on Wisconsin's voter ID law and how it's playing out in the courts. First, though, we're zeroing in on Governor Scott Walker's just unveiled plan for a second term. The new broad plan includes education, jobs, tax cuts, and public assistance restrictions. Governor Walker calls the plan continuing Wisconsin's comeback, Scott Walker's plan for greater prosperity for all. Andrew Rashofsky is with us now to talk about the plan. He's a fellow at the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and a professor emeritus at UW-Madison. Andrew, welcome to Central Time.
Hello.
Well, what was your initial reaction to Governor Walker's new plan?
Well, frankly, I was disappointed with the governor's proposed plans. Although it includes some good ideas, on the whole, I think it will not be successful in what I think the main goals of the state are, to improve our economy, to create jobs, to increase income and income growth. And in the long run, it may well do more harm than good.
One analyst said a lot of the plan is things that we've seen before from the governor, Charles Franklin. Would you say that this new plan mostly reinforces economic ideas Governor Walker has introduced already?
I think it has. Many of the ideas have been proposed before. What's new but also not new are the governor's continuing to want to continue to reduce taxes. He calls for income tax reductions, taxes to be lower in 2018 than the current rates, and he calls for property tax reductions also. And obviously, this is a theme that the governor has pursued well before he was governor.
And do you put that down? Is it something that you think the governor believes in, or is it something that will be a good move in an election year?
I won't comment on the politics of it, but from the standpoint of an economist, cutting, and I'll focus first on income taxes, cutting income taxes as a way of spurring economic growth has been, I think, thoroughly proven not to be an effective strategy. There's a lot of evidence from economic research that suggests that just cutting income taxes and income taxes alone are a very small part of decisions of businesses and individuals to locate in the state. And if we need evidence, we only have to look at Kansas, where Governor Brownback, as you know, cut income taxes dramatically, and the consequence has been rapid growth in their budget gap. And in Wisconsin, where we cut income taxes, the result has not been rapid job creation and rapid growth, but rather a growth in our budget gap.
Looking at those tax cuts a little more closely, it does remain a popular idea, largely because people like having the extra money. And one idea being that if people have extra money, they'll put that money back into the economy. Is there something that you feel would work better than that?
Well, I think that it's not like income taxes, we'll have lower income taxes, but that's offset by also having lower public services, spending less money on education, on roads, on the whole range of things that the states do, and spending less money means less resources into the state. And if people have a little higher income, they spend it on lots of things. Only a small fraction of that comes back to Wisconsin. We buy goods that were produced not only in other states but around the world. So the impact of an income tax cut on state economic growth is very weak indeed.
Now, you said at the beginning that you were disappointed and that you thought some of the ideas in Governor Walker's plan could harm Wisconsin's budget. We've been talking about taxes. Are there other things that you think add to that argument?
I would focus, one, on the proposed additional 2 years of tuition freeze at the UW or for UW system schools. Everybody might like lower tuition, and it's certainly probably good politics, but it's really bad economics. where are the resources going to come for continuing to support the university? Many of the students who come to the university need financial assistance and are struggling, but many other students at the university system come from middle-class families and upper-middle-class families who have been saving for college. Tuition in Wisconsin is, relatively speaking, a really good deal. And giving everyone a tuition freeze provides benefits to people who would come to school anyway and who have saved money for school. And as I think university officials have pointed out, freezing tuition and not having a large increase in state funding, which the governor is not proposing, means further cuts in the university. And some of our best faculty, ones who are bringing in lots of grants, millions of dollars of grants, will more likely leave. And so without education and improving the quality of education, I think the long-run prospects for growth and income growth in particular in Wisconsin are greatly diminished.
Now, there was news a few weeks ago that the structural deficit in Wisconsin is growing. What public policies do you see leading to structural deficit?
The deficit, and there's been quite a bit of comparison with structural deficits in previous years and at the end of the Doyle administration. What's different about this structural deficit is that it's not due, as the previous one was, to the recession and sharply declining revenues. This structural deficit is attributable primarily to policies made by the governor and the legislature over the last few years, namely cutting back on income taxes. And there was just released today some data from the Rockefeller Institute of Government that compared tax revenue in the second quarter of this year to the previous year. And in Wisconsin, tax revenue fell by 12%, while for the nation at whole, it was under 2%, the reduction. And that's due primarily to the fact that we cut income tax rates, and people like lower income tax, but the flip side of that is there's less revenue and we generate a deficit.
Now, can you talk a little bit about the difference between deficit and debt?
Sure. The deficit, let me just take a moment and define what a structural deficit really is. And the terms that get used in the $1.8 billion and so forth are numbers calculated by the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, and their numbers really don't account for, on the one hand, growth in revenue over the next biennium, or on the other hand, growth in the cost of providing governments. And just the released budget, I think, by Department of Health Services suggests that in order to provide the kind of health care in Wisconsin as we have done in the past, will require, I think, $750 million extra dollars. To provide education is going to cost more money. Citizens of this state get older over time, increasing health care costs. There are more students, and increases education costs. And the real concept of structural deficit is, given your tax system, how much revenue you're going to raise relative to the amount you need to do what we've done in the past. And that gap is large and is growing.
Well, and another part of this is the last time Governor Walker faced a large structural deficit, he patched it with a big budget repair bill, which, as you know, was a major issue here in Wisconsin. So whoever is governor next, are they going to need another budget repair bill or something similar to sort through this?
I think whoever is governor will need to either raise revenues or cut services. There's no other solution, or some, hopefully some mix of those two.
We're talking right now with Andrew Reschofsky about Governor Walker's new plan. He calls it Continuing Wisconsin's Comeback, Scott Walker's Plan for Greater Prosperity for All. What do you think of his plan? Do you like the measures Governor Walker says he'll implement? And what do you think Wisconsin needs for an economic comeback? Or is Wisconsin already on the right track? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. We'll continue this conversation and get to your calls in a minute. Now here's a look at some of the latest news with Kristen Durst. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our conversation with economist Andrew Reschofsky about Governor Walker's broad new plan for what he calls Wisconsin's comeback. And we're taking your calls now. What is your reaction to Governor Walker's plan? What do you like or not like about the plan? What alternatives do you think Wisconsin needs for an economic comeback? And will this plan influence your vote in November? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@WPR.org. And we go to Michael now, joining us in St. Croix Falls. Hi, Michael.
Hi there. It's good to hear you. Good to be on the show. I just wanted to address what I felt was actually probably going to be a huge factor in the structural deficit of the state, if not some of the immediate debt. When Obamacare or the national health care was passed, we were required to expand our health care services. And for what looked to me like a lot of partisan politics, we left a lot of money that would have been granted to the state on the table. And health care is a pretty expensive thing to cover. But now we don't have that money. We're cutting income taxes, reducing the revenue, on top of policies that I feel are also harmful, such as, well, I don't know if that's actually, if this is actually intended for the next budget plan, but he wants to do drug testing for low-income people, where in Florida they showed it was very expensive, but most people didn't do it. It was ridiculously high. 90% of the people were clean. I mean, serious drug addiction doesn't work that way. It's not like people miraculously quit, you know, some serious drug problems to get their welfare check or their aid. I mean, people lose homes and family over that sort of thing. But it is extremely costly, and we're not really raising any new revenues to deal with it. And just on the general income tax cut, well, I think it's good to put more money in the hands of more people. Like, what you save in a year on your tax money is really not that much. It's not enough to generate a super strong consumer base or high jobs. I mean, sure, more of these people spend, but the things they spend those money on might already be in things like well-established monopolies like Walmart. And things that provide services to people of low income.
Gotcha. Thank you so much, Michael, raising a couple of points there. But let's key in on that first one about the federal money that was turned down. Michael says it's going to hurt the budget and we have less revenue coming in. And overall, he thinks it's going to hurt the economy. What do you say to that, Andrew Reschofsky?
I agree with him. I think the number is something like $300 million, at least that's one estimate. And these were political decisions that were made rather than economic decisions, I suspect.
And do you want to weigh in at all about the drug testing? I don't know if that has an economic impact, does it?
Well, I mean, one thing that strikes me is that many of our citizens get money from the state, the elderly, farmers, students with reduced tuition, and the governor hasn't proposed drug testing for those recipients of public largesse. Rather, those people who are unfortunately of low income or temporary unemployed. And one might ask, is the aim really to cut state spending to the needy?
Right, and that seems so. That's one prong that Michael addressed there, the drug testing, and he's also hoping to move people more quickly into jobs or part-time jobs or job training and thereby offer less public assistance. Would measures like that theoretically help the economy, give some money back, or help the state save some money?
I'm a little skeptical. Obviously, federal welfare reform of a number of years ago restricted the time that people can be on state aid and welfare payments. And we have a number of existing programs that provide job training. So it's a little bit unclear whether there's much that the governor can do to make a big difference.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for the call, Michael. And we're going to go next to Adam in Bayview. Hey, Adam.
Oh, my gosh. Hi.
What do you think?
Oh, my gosh. Well, first of all, huge fan of the show, and I'm super nervous about talking on radio. This is exciting. Scott Walker in general. As county exec, he would do a lot of tax cuts, which I know sounds like really, really nice, but the money's got to come from somewhere. I used to be a very avid public transportation user. I used the bus all the time. We used to have a world-class bus system that, for what we were paying, was phenomenal. And once he made those tax cuts, I mean, the money had to come from somewhere, so a lot of cuts came on transportation. And that's what's going to happen statewide. This is going to sound really, really nice, but what's going to come at a cost? The money has to come from somewhere. So are we going to lose more of our park systems? Or, there's just a lot there. So I think moderates like myself, they don't think about this on voting day.
Great. Well, thank you for calling, and glad to have you on for the first time as a caller, Adam. And Andrew, he's considering, Adam, the trade-off there, that the extra money from savings on taxes might be good, but that there will be a price elsewhere in the state, different services, different things that people use. Is he right about that?
I think he is largely right about that, and we haven't talked explicitly about property tax cuts, but that's part of the governor's proposal. And if you cut property taxes, what does that mean? That means property taxes fund state local services, police and fire, local parks, education. If there's less money, that new money replacement for the property tax is not going to come from state or from federal money. And so it means reduced services. And Wisconsin competes with other states and competes to get businesses and residents. And in the long run, people are looking for a state that provides good services, that has a good environment, has good schools, safe streets. And I think some of these policies over time will jeopardize those things that has made Wisconsin really a special place.
Well, thanks a lot for that call. And I think we have time for one more call. George in Milwaukee joins us now. Hi, George.
Hi. I think in Wisconsin, we have a tremendously diverse economy. And when you compare it to other surrounding states, and a lot of great things going for us. But one thing that gets talked about over and over is the importance of not just higher education, but also technical education, getting more excitement about being a tradesperson, whether it's welding, whether it's going into working for manufacturing plants of the future. There's a whole set of people that maybe aren't going to be going out and being engineers, but they've got great skills. And we really need to emphasize the technical college infrastructure and continue to push that. That benefits everybody. That's my comment. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, George. And it's worth pointing out that Governor Walker's proposed plan that we're discussing right now also calls for a freezing of tuition at technical colleges. I don't know how that might affect the budget, but what do you think about George's comment, Andrew?
I think expanding access to technical colleges is a good thing to do, but cutting tuition again and freezing it for everyone reduces revenue to pay the people who are giving courses and to expand tuition. So we need perhaps lower tuition, but on the other side, we need more public investment in technical colleges and the programs that they provide.
Does it make education more accessible to parents and students?
Lower tuition can make it more accessible for some. Much better would be to say, let's target students who really need assistance and provide them with aid, and let those who can afford to pay pay for the costs of higher education, whether it's technical colleges or universities.
And in our final moments here, Andrew, as the budget plans has more time in the public and more time to digest it, what do you think people's response will be? We've heard yours.
That's a good question. I think I would hope that people will not only look at tax cuts and saying, oh, that's a good thing, but ask the broader question of, if the government has less revenue, which services do I want to give up? And realize that there are two sides to the coin, and that the services that I think most people appreciate and want and think are necessary for economic growth cost money, and freezing revenue is not a solution.
Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
That was Andrew Ushofsky, fellow at the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and a professor emeritus at UW-Madison. He was with us to talk about Governor Walker's new broad plan for Wisconsin if he gets reelected. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is off today. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the behind the scenes of Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. First, we're getting a behind the scenes look at how Wisconsin's controversial voter ID law is playing out in federal court. On Friday, a three-judge panel reinstated Wisconsin's voter ID law. Now, election officials in the state say people who have already submitted absentee ballots will have to present their photo IDs for their votes to be counted. Then late on Tuesday, the American Civil Liberties Union filed an emergency appeal to the court's decision to put the law into place, saying the election is already underway. Kimmy King is here to explain how the law is being decided in the courts and what happens next. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, what do you make of the move to implement this law less than 50 days before the next election here in the state?
It's actually a very bold move out of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals to push the law forward and to simply say we're not going to hang around and wait for the appellate process to have worked and to have finalized, I should say, to have finalized that we need to move forward on this. This law has been around since 2011, and therefore we need to go ahead and start the process of implementation. And just because there may be some difficulties associated with it doesn't mean that we're going to delay it any further. It is a little bit surprising that, given that it's so close to the election, that they did push forward with it. But one of the things that you do see out of appeals courts is that they will move a case along and lift stays if they believe that their decision is going to withstand an appeal.
Interesting. Well, this was reinstated after a hearing from a three-judge panel. Why did it go to that three-judge panel first instead of the full court?
So one of the things that's interesting is it's this process of how cases get heard at the trial level and then at the court of appeal level. One of the things about voting rights cases is that they, and it's also the same reason that somebody could ask, well, why did the Wisconsin Supreme Court have this case and why is it in the federal courts and why are they looking to have the full panel hear the case? So understand that the federal voting rights guarantees are kind of a minimum floor that each state has to provide and can't go below in terms of violating some sort of right. But that being said, you have states which under the Constitution are allowed to regulate and monitor and actually are the ones carrying out elections. So you have this interaction between state and federal court, and because we're talking about federal civil rights and voting rights, there are different kinds of procedures that can be triggered that are actually written into the laws to provide additional protection. And so what the ACLU in filing this case is doing is it's trying to say, look, there is a provision for emergency appeals that when you get these kinds of cases to move for an expedited appeal so that we can resolve this issue or put the stay back on.
There was news breaking this morning that some 11,000 absentee ballots that had already been sent out, that those people who had already voted from that number would have to follow the new voter ID law, would have to present some form of ID along with that ballot. Why do those people who've already voted via absentee ballot have to follow the new law when it wasn't in place when they voted?
Well, this is going to be the issue on appeal, and certainly this is going to be part of the grounds of what the ACLU is going to try to argue. Part of the reason for why the court probably felt, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals Court, I should say, we've got different kinds of opinions out there, but why the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decision felt that it was probably okay to do that is because that in a prior case that had been heard in 2008, there had been this 2005 Indiana law that had upheld photo identification. And so what had wound up being upheld is that what the court said is that you can do a provisional ballot if you don't have the right identification. And as long as you come back in 10 days and give us the right identification, then you will have met the requirements and your provisional ballot can become a real ballot. What the Marion case says is, in essence, that there can be a little bit of additional hurdle that the states may place on people for getting that ID and to provide it. That is an altogether different question than what is presented by your Wisconsin voter ID issue. This is an implementation of a new rule where people don't have IDs. So the burden placed on persons trying to exercise what is considered to be a fundamental right will be much greater. And therefore, the ACLU is, I'm sure, going to try to argue that that burden, you know, interferes with basic federal civil rights.
So the ACLU has filed an emergency appeal on the voter ID decision. What should we expect to happen next with that?
So what's going to happen is I believe that they have appealed to the full panel, and basically it's a way of saying, look, we think this Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals with these three judges, who everybody's talking about the fact that they're Republican judges, these three judges have 50 Republican judges, you know, 50 days before a major election in which in which Scott Walker is locked in a tight race. Let's be clear about the political stake that's involved in these cases, is attempting to try to put in place a law that will interfere and that the state is not ready for. And so that, I would imagine, is going to be the thrust of their argument.
How long should we expect that to take to get an answer on this latest appeal from the full court?
Part of it goes down to kind of paying attention to what the Seventh Circuit and the ideology and the political bent of the Seventh Circuit. So a lot of the court watchers are going to be trying to, you know, point out, and they're going to be looking back at this Crawford versus Marion County Election Board because, you know, there again, you had a Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and both the District Court and the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals had upheld the law, right? This is a very different set of circumstances than what was presented in that case. So part of it's going to depend on the extent to which within the Seventh Circuit there are these divides that, yeah, this is a different case from what we were looking at in the Indiana law, and we need to take that into consideration because we are going to have people that had already exercised their right to vote under a different law, and or, you know, the law prior to have it been put back in place, and now their votes will in essence be disenfranchised. Now the Seventh Circuit might carve it out, and here's another thing to watch for. They might say those that have already voted, it is a lawful vote because the law at the time was that you did not need to have the voter ID. So this kind of crazy scheme of making people go turn in their identification after the fact, yeah, that interferes with the, you know, the fundamental right that you have to vote. However, for those going forward, because we find that this is a valid law and we find that it is legitimate to have this kind of voter ID, you are going to have to provide it. Now, what about those folks that don't have the voter ID? And that's where we're going to have to watch and see what the Seventh Circuit, how they view that, because that is the issue that is not so clear.
So those are some of the issues that we'll be watching. But how likely do you think it is that the voter ID law will still be in place for the November 4th election?
Wow, I wish I knew. I could make a lot of money predicting these things. I will tell you, as a general rule, we've seen the growth of voter identification laws spread across the country. I'm down here in Texas, and our voter ID law continues to have, you know, challenges, but it's currently in place. We have one of the most restrictive voter identification laws. And if you look across the country, increasingly states are putting in place voter identification laws. Now, certainly not as many, you know, are doing what Texas has done because we have a fairly restrictive one. But states are enacting those, and the general trend seems to be for supporting reasonable voter identification regulations. Now, what constitutes reasonable? This is what the court's going to get into. Is it reasonable to require that persons who might not otherwise have the appropriate voter identification be required to go out and get those 50 days before the election? Because remember, your Department of Motor Vehicles can run like a 2-3 month wait on being able to get driver's license or photo identifications. And so those kinds of delays and the ability of the ACLU to point to those are the kinds of things that are going to militate in favor of keeping the stay on for this election. The long-term prognosis, that's just for this short-term one. So I think the likelihood in this case, if I had to place a bet, I would say that I think that they might do something that limits the scope of that Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decision. Then you still have the long-term issue of can Wisconsin have a voter ID? And I think that where the courts are going with this is that they are going to uphold voter IDs.
Okay, we'll be watching and so will you. Kimmy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Kimmy King, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Texas, talking about Wisconsin's voter ID law and how it could play out in court. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and it's time for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. The House is voting today on President Obama's plan to combat the Islamic State movement. It's an amendment to a bill that will also fund the federal government through December. And for years, the U.S. Senate has been following a secret set of rules that describes how they can and cannot spend taxpayer dollars, among a bunch of other things. The official Senate guidebook was obtained by USA Today and published earlier this week. We'll hear about that. Paul Singer takes us behind the scenes with his commentary on Congress every week at this time. Hey, Paul, how's it going?
Going so far so good. And yourself, Veronica?
It's going pretty well, thanks. Well, I want to start with this House vote today.
Yep.
It's apparently not an authorization of military force against ISIS or ISIL. What exactly is it?
Right. It is very clearly not an authorization of military force. Congress is authorizing the administration to arm and train Syrian rebels. This is the group that we had wanted to arm. The Obama administration wanted to arm these folks to fight against Syrian President Assad. Now they want to arm and train them to help fight against ISIL or ISIS or the Islamic State. So what they're saying is that you may now officially, formally begin training and arming these fighters. They are not saying that we may launch a war in Syria, and they are not saying that we can introduce U.S. ground troops in the area. That continues to be off the table, and Obama said again today that he is not planning to send ground troops. That is not part of his strategy.
Now, is this vote actually necessary to U.S. action, or is this a formality?
The Pentagon has said this is necessary. They have been using back channels to get weapons to the Syrians, but they needed an actual public declaration to allow them, they needed a law passed to allow them to legally, publicly engage, basically have the Defense Department directly engage with the Syrian forces there. Keep in mind, this is also a temporary measure. Because it's attached to this short-term spending bill, it only extends through December, so Congress will have an opportunity to sort of revisit this whole issue then to see whether they are getting what they expected out of it.
Hmm. Well, is there anyone right now in Congress who's saying, you know, hang on a second, this is tantamount to military force, so we should have a vote about that?
Yeah, you've got a number of people sort of raising the issue of whether we should be involved at all. I mean, I think it was Loretta Sanchez of California today in the House saying, you know, if you start to engage in something like this, we're going to have American troops there doing the training, and sooner or later we're going to be involved in the ground war. It's just sort of the next, it's kind of a slippery slope argument. You will find, I think, some conservative Republicans and some liberal Democrats agreeing that this is not a good idea, specifically because it basically reintroduces American forces into the conflict, and they're very much afraid of what that might lead to. But they're going to be outnumbered. I think this House, this vote is going to be a pretty one-sided in the House in favor.
Is there any conflict here in the sense that the Republican-controlled House would be giving the president, you know, kind of what he wants heading into fall elections?
Well, yeah, except that I think the Republicans feel that in some ways this was their agenda in the first place. I mean, Republicans have been saying all along that we needed a more forceful policy in Syria and in the area, a more forceful reaction to the Islamic militants. To some degree, this is Republicans endorsing Obama's strategy, which is not far from what the Republicans wanted in the first place. Whether or not this is good, keep in mind, for either party going to November campaigns, it's hard to really tell. I'm not sure that the American public is going to be all that excited about more forceful military action in the Middle East again. So there's some question about who this is really good for on a political ground. But I think the leadership, both parties, Democrats and Republicans in the Congress, have said, we just need to do this. It's clear this ISIL group is a threat, and the American military needs to engage them in some way.
Now, briefly before we move on, you are hearing some voices now calling for boots on the ground in some fashion, including Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, who said so on Central Time a few weeks ago. How big a deal is that?
Well, I mean, again, this is the slippery slope argument, right? I mean, the fact of the matter is, at the moment, there are, I think, 1,500 U.S. military personnel on the ground in Iraq, helping to protect American facilities or American personnel or critical Iraqi facilities, helping to train the military there. I mean, the fact of the matter is we're on the ground. Mm-hmm. What the issue is going to be is if one of those people, God forbid, is killed, or if there was an attack on American forces there, do we begin to introduce more troops? And this is where the slippery slope argument comes, that, you know, sooner or later, there probably are going to be American boots on the ground, or at least there's going to be somebody's boots on the ground. It's a question of whether America is training and equipping them or is, in fact, providing the troops.
So moving on, USA Today unveiled some interesting news earlier this week about what has been apparently guiding the administration behind the scenes in the Senate for a long time. It seems like it's sort of skull and bones for the Senate.
Yeah.
What is this guidebook you got a hold of?
You know, I'm really embarrassed by this one because I've covered congressional ethics for years. And we've talked about all, you know, in the House, there's a handbook that basically describes what you're allowed to and not allowed to do when spending your office accounts. That is, a taxpayer-provided account for running your congressional office.
To the tune of millions of dollars.
Yeah, it's $2 to $4 million a year per senator. In the House, this book is public. It's on their website. You can read it. And it tells you what you can and cannot do. In the Senate, every time we've gotten to one of these things, we've had to ask someone to send us a copy of the rules or where are the rules. And we can never really find the thing. Finally, it dawned on me that I could get someone to just leak me the whole book. and they did. This thing has never been public. The committee that prints the thing wouldn't release it. The government printing office that prints it wouldn't give it to me. We're like, what do you mean this thing is secret? These are the rules you live by. How can it be secret? I'm like, well, we don't release it because it has some security information regarding the Congress, which is true. There are 10 pages about basically what do you do if there's a bomb threat. And again, it's written for Senate staff and senators on how you run your office. So there is some stuff about security and how to get an ID badge and stuff like that. But we thought it was absurd that this thing had never been public. And I was frankly embarrassed that I had never before just tried to have someone give it to me. Now we have it. We post it on the website. Everybody can look at it.
Which is quite a coup, considering the Library of Congress doesn't even have a copy of it.
What was
the most surprising thing in the book?
Oh, I don't know. The most surprising thing about it is how Byzantine the United States Senate is. I mean, once again, you forget that they have rules for how many potted plants a senator can borrow from the botanic gardens. They have rules for how many pieces of paper you are allocated as a senator. 1 1/3 sheets for each adult constituent. I mean, you know, it's the stuff that could have come straight out of the Central Committee of the Soviet Union in the 1930s. You know,
yeah.
It's just so completely Byzantine and bureaucratic. It's just wildly entertaining.
So is the takeaway here that now we know a little bit more about what's allowed ethically when you senators are spending money, taxpayer money, running their offices?
Yeah, and where the sort of rubber hits the road here is we came to this book this time around because we've been studying how senators are using charter flights using taxpayer money to pay for charter flights. And what we discovered is a bunch of the lawmakers chartering aircraft to travel around the state, which is legitimate. But we want to see the rules for how and when they're allowed to. And in fact, what happened after that, after we started writing those stories, we began to discover several senators had been paying for trips with taxpayer dollars that were not proper. They were, in fact, campaign trips, not official trips, and they should have been paid for out of the campaign. Now that this book is public, anybody can follow a member of Congress's travel, see where they are, and go look it up in the book. Does this fit the rules of something that should be funded by the taxpayer, or is this something that should not be funded by the taxpayer? That's the kind of stuff this rule book tells you, and I think it's important that the voter is able to look at it and say, hey, I think my senator is doing something that is not within the rules.
Well, congratulations on getting a hold of it, Paul, and some little light reading there if people want to go to bed.
300 pages of fun.
So we'll talk more about another story we didn't get to, hopefully next week. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Veronica. Have a great day.
We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time to keep us up to date on what's going on in Congress.